We are in the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 33, and I want to start at verse number 18 as we continue looking at the final blessing of Moses upon the tribes of Israel. It's the day that he's going to head up to Mount Pisgah, which will hereafter be known as Mount Nebo, that is, Mount Prophet. He is going to die, because he's not allowed to go into the Promised Land, and the Israelis will be doing that before too much longer. But before he goes, he is prompted, I think, by the Holy Spirit to present a blessing upon all the different tribes. And there seems to be a connection to where their tribal region is located, or what it is that they're going to do as a group in the future. And we've seen two groups in particular highlighted well, and that was the Levites, because they're going to be the teaching and worship arm for Israel as a nation. And we just saw that there was a lot said about the Joseph tribes, Manasseh and Ephraim, about how blessed they were, and how strong they are, and how they will fight for Israel. Now we're ready for the remaining tribes to get their blessing from Moses. And you should picture this with Moses kind of addressing all of Israel one last time. And then according to the tradition found in the writings of Josephus from the first century A.D., he will then go up the hill a little ways with the Sanhedrin, that's the 70 leaders, and with the high priest Eleazar, and with Joshua, and then he will eventually go the rest of the way by himself. So that's the way we should kind of picture this day going. Oh, one last thing. The traditional date, according to that Josephus record, is the first day of the 12th month of the 40th year of the Exodus. Now, that's just from tradition. It's not found in the inspired text. Verse 18 of chapter 33. Of Zebulun, he said, "Rejoice, Zebulun, in your going out, and Issachar, in your tents." So these two are kind of matched up together. And guess what? In the coming inheritance for the different tribal regions, they will be neighbors. They basically are the eastern and western part of the Israelian Valley, that is the valley that stretches south of Galilee and north of the of Samaria in the future. It's a big breadbasket area, but there's also some mountainous regions, some hilly regions to it. And it says here, they shall call peoples to their mountain, and there they shall offer right sacrifices, for they draw from the abundance of the seas and the hidden treasures of the sand. So the mountain here is probably not where they live up in the north, but rather the mountain of God's worship. Now, eventually, that will be the Temple Mount. But for a while, it will be Shiloh, which is in the mountainous region of Ephraim. But they have a mention here of the seas, which is intriguing, because the usual understanding of their tribal boundaries doesn't touch the sea, doesn't touch water in a large body. It doesn't touch the Sea of Galilee. It doesn't touch the Jordan River. Doesn't touch the Mediterranean coast. And I've mentioned before, in reference to one of these two tribes, that there was another blessing mentioning the sea, and I wonder whether or not there was some sort of future access, right away, that went right down to the seacoast from one of these tribes, which made them kind of the purveyors of products from the sea. But we don't know. There's not enough information to understand why the seas are attached to these two landlocked tribes. Verse number 20. Of Gad, he said. Now, Gad is another one of the tribes that is only going to inherit on the east side of the Jordan, because that's what they asked for. And that comes into the promise here. Blessed be he who enlarges Gad. Gad crouches like a lion, and he tears off arm and scalp. Now, that's a funny thing to see as a blessing, but it is. It's picturing him as this ferocious lion that is able to take care of itself by taking down prey. But then verse 21, he chose the best of the land for himself, for there a commander's portion was reserved. Gad, Reuben, and the half-tribe of Manasseh all requested from Moses the ability to inherit the land east of the Jordan, which they'd recently taken from Sihon and Og, because it was good land for running cattle on, and they had lots of cattle. Moses kind of got after him to begin with, because he thought they were going to put, you know, the fear of going into the promised land into the other tribes. So he extracted from them a promise that they would be in the vanguard. They would be at the head of the forces going into the promised land to take it for their brother tribes. And then they would be able to go back to their requested land. So that all comes out here, that they become the commanding force of the taking of the promised land, but then they requested that they be given land to the east of the promised land. So that's all here in the promise, in the blessing. He came with the heads of the people, with Israel. He executed the justice of He who is and His judgments for Israel. So they are at the head of the take the promised land military force. Verse 22. Of Dan, he said, Dan is a lion's cub that leaps from Bashan. So here we have the imagery of a very ferocious lion that gets what it wants. But Dan's property is actually down along the northwest borderline of Judah territory, far from Bashan. However, as we will discover when we get into the book of Judges, a large group of people from Dan didn't like the territory that they'd been given, and so they migrated up north looking for a particular city that was open to conquest, and they attacked it and took it over. And guess what? That city, which they gave the name Dan to, is in the northwest extremity of Bashan. And so that seems to be what we have referenced here, is the Dan Lions Club leaping on this city up in Bashan and taking it over for themselves. Verse 23, of Naphtali, he said, Oh, Naphtali, sated with favor and full of the blessing of He who is, possess the lake and south. The tribe of Naphtali ends up occupying the territory to the west and northwest of the Sea of Galilee. And so that seems to be what's being played with here in the wording, because the word for lake and the word for west, or the idea of in the west, can mean, or it can be the same word, meaning both things poetically at the same time. So they take over the area near the Sea of Galilee. Verse 24, of Asher. Most blessed of sons be Asher. Let him be the favorite of his brothers, and let him dip his oil, his foot in oil. Now, I remember way back in my younger years as a minister, there were a whole bunch of people that were grabbing a hold of this passage and saying, there's oil in Israel. It's under the tribal territory of Asher. Now, Asher's territory was the coastline north of Haifa. That's a modern-day city. The little bump on the Mediterranean coast of the country of Israel is where Haifa is located. And so Asher was right up in that region. And there were a bunch of these Christian promoters of oil exploration that started companies, and they tried to get people invest, and they said, we know prophetically there's going to be oil underneath that land. And they went, and they didn't really find anything. And some people lost their shirts because they believed that they were investing in prophecy. The oil that's being referenced here is olive oil. And the whole region along that coastline that's also south of Tyre and Sidon, those hills are just covered with olive groves. And so that is what Moses was predicting, was that they would have a lot of olive oil in their territory. And then in verse 25, he says, your bars, these are the bars on your cities, you know, the gates with the locking bars. Your bars shall be iron and bronze, so they're going to be strong. And as your days, so shall your strength be. So you will be strong and be around for a good long time. And then we have the wrap-up. There is none like God, O Yasharun. Remember, there's the upright nickname for Israel, who rides through the heavens to your help, through the skies in his majesty. So there's nobody like God that comes to your rescue. The eternal God is your dwelling place. So he's the place where you can be safe and secure. And underneath are the everlasting arms. And so here we've got, you know, the source text for a song, leaning on the everlasting arms, right? The picture is, of course, God's always got you when you fall. And so he thrust out the enemy before you and said, destroy. Now that's getting ready to happen. Moses includes it in the blessing here. And so Israel lived in safety. Jacob lived alone, in the sense that nobody's troubling him, in a land of grain and wine whose heavens drop down dew. Happy are you, O Israel. Who is like you? A people saved by He who is. Now, I like that line because, as I've told many of you over and over again, it has the word for salvation in close proximity to the divine name. And that always reminds me of Jesus, whose name means He who is salvation. And then we have God also being referred to as the shield of your hope, the sword of your triumph. Your enemies shall come fawning to you, and you shall tread upon their backs. So he closes this up with the whole martial, poetic picture of what's about to happen. The Israelis are going to go in and take over the promised land with God leading them. And so that finishes the blessings of Moses, chapter 34. Then Moses went up from the plains of Moab to Mount Nebo, or Mount Prophet, to the top of Pisgah, which, I've kind of forgotten what Pisgah means here. See if I can find that real quick. Oh, it's cleft. It's the idea of like a rocky area, which is opposite Jericho. And he who has showed him all the land, Gilead, that's to the north on the east side of the Jordan. So Moses can see that just upriver from where he's at. As far as Dan, remember Dan is going to be the northernmost major city in the Promised Land, probably a future editor, we're going to refer to them as that, added the word Dan here in as a reminder that that's how far up into the north he could kind of see so that the people would have a good reference point. All Naphtali, that's over by the Sea of Galilee, so apparently from where he's at, he can kind of see a little bit of the Sea of Galilee as well. The land of Ephraim and Manasseh, that's immediately across to the northwest from where Mount Pisgah is located. You go across the Jordan. So he's looking across there, and he can see that area. And all the land of Judah, that's right in front of him, across the Jordan and across the Dead Sea. And it's very likely that he could see maybe a little piece, a little thin slice of the Mediterranean from where he's at. But most certainly you can see the open air above that. And the Negev. Negev is the southern area of Judah. And so he can see that far off to the southwest. And the plain, that is the valley of Jericho, the city of palm trees, as far as Zoar. So Jericho is just, I think, roughly 15, 16 miles from where he's at on Mount Pisgah. So he can see that right in front of him. But then he can look down to the south and see all of the north basin of the Dead Sea. And Zoar is on the extreme south east portion of the south basin, which he might be able to see a glimpse of. So he can see an awful lot of the promised land from this viewing platform that God has directed to him. He who is said to him, "This is the land of which I swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, I will give it to your offspring." So this is the property of the promise. "I have let you see it with your eyes, but you shall not go over there." So again, that he's on a penalty that doesn't allow him to do so. So Moses, the servant of He Who Is, died there in the land of Moab, according to the word of He Who Is. So he's clearly alone. He left behind Eleazar, the priest, and Joshua and all of those farther down the slope. And he, meaning God, buried him in the valley in the land of Moab opposite Beth Peor. But no one knows the place of his burial to this day. So absolutely no possible way that anybody could be certain where the grave of Moses is. Now, some people have tried to specify where the grave of Moses is, but no. The scripture itself says that's impossible. Now, it is interesting that the little church building that I mentioned that's on the top of traditional Mount Peor was placed there because they were thinking that that would be where Moses' grave would be located. But it's the text says that he wasn't buried where he viewed from, but rather he was buried in a valley nearby. And the word for valley here indicates a sharp-sided gully. And wouldn't you know it, there is such a sharp-sided gully between the traditional ridgeline and the ridgeline that I was talking about earlier, about a mile south. If you follow that little gully, that little valley down toward the Jordan Valley, you come right past where the encampment of Israel was located. So I think it's likely that Moses is buried somewhere in that gully. Verse 7, Moses was 120 years old when he died. So he reached the maximum that God kind of placed as a norm for humanity back at the time of the flood. And eventually, everybody kind of got down to not exceeding that upper limit. You might remember that Aaron was 3 years older than Moses. So when he died, he was 123. And Miriam, who also died earlier in the 40th year, was probably as much as 6 years older than Moses. So she probably died at 136 or maybe even a little bit, 126 or maybe a little bit older. But the point of what the prophet that's putting this additional information, probably Joshua, is that his eye was undimmed and his vigor unabated. So he is at the exceeding upper limit of humanity's lifespan now, and he was perfectly healthy. God just simply turned him off, shut him down, because he was not allowed to go into the promised land. Verse 8, the people of Israel wept for Moses in the plains of Moab 30 days. Now, the typical mourning period was about a week. But if it was a big community person, such as Miriam, such as Aaron, and now such as Moses, they would weep for a total of 30 days. And so this is, I think, one of the reasons why the Jewish tradition is that Moses died on the first day of the 12th month of the Jewish year, because then if you have an entire month of weeping and mourning over him, and then the next month is going to start a brand new year. And they know from the book of Joshua that Israel goes into the promised land very early in the first month of the 41st year of the Exodus. So I think that's probably why they went with the tradition of Moses dying on the first day of the 12th month. Verse 9, Joshua, the son of Nun, was full of the spirit of wisdom, for Moses had laid his hands on him. So the Holy Spirit empowerment that Moses had received from God has now been fully transferred over to Joshua. God had actually done that already. And so when he comes back to the encampment without Moses, he is immediately acknowledged as the new leader of Israel. And so this is what's reported. The people of Israel obeyed him and did as he who is had commanded Moses. And there has not arisen a prophet since in Israel like Moses, whom he who is knew face to face. None like him for all the signs and the wonders that he who is sent him to do in the land of Egypt, to Pharaoh and to all his servants and to all his land, and for all the mighty power and all the great deeds of terror that Moses did in the sight of all Israel. Now, I've already mentioned that Deuteronomy is Moses' final address to Israel, which gets put into writing. But not all of it was written by him. We have little elements, such as this here at the tail end, that must have been written by others. I'd already said that I think that Joshua was involved, probably, in writing some of this. But the last few verses, from verse 9 down to verse 12, seem to have been written by an even later prophet who points out we've never had anyone quite as amazing as Moses yet here in Israel. Now, why is that important? Because Deuteronomy 18 promised that there would be a great prophet like unto Moses, and he would speak the words of life, and everybody would need to listen to him. Folks, Jesus was the one that fulfilled that prophecy about the prophet in Deuteronomy chapter 18.